everyone. I'm Dennis Nance. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dennis.
My home group is the Queen City Group in Charlotte, North Carolina. My sobriety date is February 1st of 1981. Man, that's a lot to say. I'd like to thank the committee, and especially John and Graham, for inviting me down, and anybody else that had something to do with me being here. And those of you that know me know that my wife, Libra, usually travels with me, but she's taking a course in summer school this summer, so she's not here. As a matter of fact, I'm glad she failed her first test, and John, she did finally pass that on the second try. You know, that was a big deal when I left home. I don't have anything profound to say, so I hate to disappoint you guys. You know, up in North Carolina, we're not as refined and sophisticated as you are guys down here in the major cities. I guess you know how backward our education program is from the news. So we hadn't yet figured out what causes alcoholism. The best we can tell is drinking liquor's got a lot to do with it. And I need to tell you, too, that I'm well aware that Alcoholics Anonymous is not the only way to recover from alcoholism. And as a matter of fact, my being here is because I tried some of those other ways. And they don't work too well. My job is simple, is to share my experience, strength, and hope with you, and do that in a general way and as efficiently as I can. And but you know, the mistake that you guys have made is you know that it's almost impossible for me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you without sharing a few of my opinions, you know? And one of the first things I realized when I got sober is that if you're sober and you have a home group and you got a sponsor and you begin to work the steps and you're 6'4" and 255 pounds, you can have an opinion if you want one, you know? So I got me one. And it's my opinion that I am sober by the grace of a loving God who manifests himself in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a never-ending circle of friends like yourself. Now, the people that have the type of sobriety that I want to develop are people who are recovering in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only way I know to do this deal. I have not been to treatment. Don't think I'll ever have to go if I'll do the best I can to use the principles that you've taught me. But I spent a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous watching you watch me. I hated old timers. Thought they hated me. I hated the way they'd come in and everybody would love on them and shake their hands, and they'd gravitate toward the soft seats at the back of the meeting. Man, I wanted to sit back there. I wanted somebody to show me some attention. And I'd watch them. They sat back there on Paisley Street at the club with the, and that place had been painted with that old epoxy paint. And that stuff was sticky enough to hold up the building without the brick. But you know, bad to get grease spots in it where they would put the head against the wall. And you could tell when one of them was missing. You'd see a spot back there, you know. And these guys were 40 and 50 years old, man. They were old. A couple of them 60, you know, and they're bad to hurt your feelings, you know. Saying stuff like, boy, if this program ain't working around your kitchen table, it ain't working around this AA table either. Man, I thought that sucked. Man, how do they know me like that? I'd complain about my wife, and they say, you know, every record has two sides. What does a song sound like on the other side of that album? No respect. One night we was complaining about the highway patrol stopping us for drunk driving. And one of the guys said something profound. He said, you know, I hadn't been charged with drunk driving since I quit drinking. Man, that is profound. I had never connected the two, you know. And that's powerful stuff. These old boys began to love me. They outlined a program of action for me. They had me going to speaker meetings. Only let me go to one discussion meeting per week. Man, I hated that, because I had some stuff you guys really needed to know. But I guess they wanted to wait a while, you know. And you know, if I have a preference today, I prefer to go to speaker meetings. And the reason why I prefer to go to speaker meetings is because I heard then what I need to hear now. I heard the onset. I heard the problem. And most importantly, I heard the solution. And see, I needed to hear the onset because the disease concept was new to me. And I needed to hear the problem for my own self-identification. Everybody knew I was a drunk. I didn't. And I needed to hear the solution to instill some hope. And that's what happened. And going to these meetings, I became convinced. I began to know that which I didn't want to know. I knew I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't like it. Just knew it. And that began this wonderful journey that I hope to share with you tonight. I'm kind of like Paul. It's evening, I guess. But anyway, I was born on a cotton farm in Shelby, North Carolina. I used to tell people that was Shelby, but actually it was some miles out of Shelby. And I instinctively knew that I was in the wrong place. Yeah, because I was supposed to be born in some white Jewish family up in Bronx, New York, you know. I'm a little too good to be picking cotton, you know. And I started having trouble right off the bat. First of all, I had all these sisters around, just surrounded by girls. Eventually had five sisters, had one brother, and I was treated special. Mom didn't have any brothers. Grandmother only had one brother, and he died at an early age. So on that side of the family, I'm special. On my dad's side of the family, he's the baby of the family, and one of the ones that didn't drink. And dad came from a long line of about 14, 6'6", 6'7", 6'8", alcoholics. And there were so many of them that they didn't even have to go to town on Saturday night. They just stay home and drink and fight, you know. And dad was never impressed with me. Dad always said, I remember him telling me many times, that, boy, you know, I think you're going to be a big man one of these days. I think you're going to be the size of my brother Henry. And then later on he told me, you know, you act like my brother Henry. Later on he was to tell me, you know, I don't think you're going to be able to drink. Well, you know, he shouldn't have told me that. But Dad was dangerous. Dad was a big man, 6'3", 265 pounds, 13 triple E shoes. I still got the footprint back here, you know. And that was back before the days of child abuse, too, you know. Back then, you know, they'd abuse you right on the spot, you know. If you went and told anybody, you'd get abused again. You know? And so on. But now, I was born between two sisters who were academically gifted. These guys started school in the second grade. Lola was skipped to the third grade and then moved back to the second grade because she was not emotionally mature enough to start the school in the third grade. And I'm sitting between them doing absolutely nothing. But I expected to get skipped any time. So I'm not just physically lazy. I'm mentally lazy, I'm emotionally lazy, I'm spiritually lazy. When I got here, I wanted what you had, but I didn't want to do anything to get it. So I wasted a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous just like I did in school. Started wearing glasses when I was 5 years old. And I was thinking about this yesterday. The first glasses I got were welfare glasses. My parents were working, and my first pair of glasses were welfare glasses. That's how poor we were back then. If I'd have known how poor we were back then, I'd tell you I'd be in a mental institution. I wouldn't be able to handle it. But they were these welfare glasses, and the hinges never tightened upon the things, you know. And I didn't realize it, and I couldn't tell the truth about it until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have a lazy eye. I have an uncooperative eye. It just does what it wants to sometimes, you know. I look up, it look back down. And sometimes I start laughing, one eye fly open, one close. And had a lot of trouble out of that eye. I was in the first grade, and a guy named Albert Chambers sitting across the table from me. He said, do that again. I said, what? I didn't know I did anything, you know. I had to quit drinking at bars, you know, so there's always some short guy, about 4'8", shows up, sits at the end of the bar. You know, my eye is the first thing to get drunk on me when I start drinking. And he said, now, you know what he say? What you looking at? I didn't know what I was looking at, you know. So here I am. I'm got these crooked welfare glasses on, this eye rolling around in my head. I mean, Dad's too cheap to buy a real haircut. Dad bought some Sears and Roebuck clippers, and they sound more like a Harley-Davidson motorcycle than they did a clippers. And Dad couldn't cut hair anyway. Seventh grade education, those big old hands wouldn't even close up tight enough on those clippers. I didn't know haircuts didn't have to hurt until I was in the Army, you know? I've been pulling my hair out all these years. And just never could get it right. Thick on one side, thin on the other. And then he'd try to put a part in it, and I'd end up with two or three parts, either one that wide. So I'm in bad shape, and I ain't even got close to liquor yet, you know? One of the things I love about Shelby back then is the spiritual training. Dad was superintendent of Sunday school. So I went to church every Sunday. And I believe I sat in the basement of Shoal Creek Baptist Church and began to perfect the very character defects that would keep me consumed by my illness for years. The first of those is the ability to manipulate people. You know, I've been sober a while now. I can come in a meeting, hadn't talked to my sponsor in 3 or 4 days, having problems at work, problems at home. I got young adult kids, they're getting in trouble, having divorces and stuff like that. No, I need to talk to somebody, and somebody will say, Dennis, how are you doing? I say, well, fine. I grab a cup of coffee, ease on to my seat. Know how to act. The other thing I began to develop there in Sunday school is a good memory. I've done that by memorizing scripture in Sunday school lessons. And you connect that with a little bit of my lying, and man, I sounded good back then. Those old folk would say, Eldridge, you've got a fine son. And before he could say anything, I'd say, ain't he though, you know, and I'd help him out a little bit, you know. But you know, those two qualities are probably my worst liabilities today. Because you hear it read at meetings, it doesn't say rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly memorized our book. It's followed the path. I never wanted to do anything. You know, if you read the book and you don't find anything in there about into memorizing, you don't find anything about into talking, you know, into thinking. It's into action. I have a clear history of inactivity. I don't like to do anything. I like to take the easy way out. Well, you know, things got a little rough there about 67, 68, North Carolina. The schools were integrating, and I was feeling weird anyway. My feet started getting long. I was wearing size 12 shoes in the seventh grade, you know. I said, man, I tell you, I was hiding them under the seat in front of me. I was afraid of the girls, couldn't talk to them. And finally, we had forced integration. And you know, I began to feel even more weird, but more of a phony. And see, back then, we were so poor that whites and blacks did everything together. We picked cotton together. We went to the store on the same pickup truck. We played together. We did about everything except went to school together. Some of us still in Shelby go to church together. So I began to wonder how I was going to interact with my white friends without being rejected by my black friends and vice versa. That was a conflict for me. The next conflict I had is at our final party. We had a departure party there in the eighth grade. We would be in the ninth grade that next year, and we had at the segregated school, we had a party. And I found out that I could not dance like everybody else was dancing. Couldn't even talk to the girls. I was in bad shape. The music was strange. You know, these guys were listening to stuff like J.J. Jackson and Gladys Knight and the Pips and Martha Rhodes and the Vandellas. I had been laying in the bathtub on Saturday night listening to a country music station out of Gaffney, South Carolina. Now, I had been listening to Conway Twitty and the Twitty Birds and Buck and the Buckaroos, Little Waylon Jennings, and Merle Haggard and the Strangers sound like a good group I might be able to relate to. But, you know, nobody told me a soul brother's supposed to listen to soul music. I'm listening to country music. And then I noticed I didn't have a cool walk like the rest of the black guys do, you know. About 13 years old, something happens to our hip. You know, we dip a little bit, you know. I didn't do that. I just cruise. I've been dragging that cotton sack for 13 years. It took the dip out of my hip. So I've got a major conflict here. I'm a soul brother, and I don't have soul. And I'm black, and I ain't cool. But now that summer, all that changed. My friend and I, Kale's still my best friend. Kale's been my best friend all my life. Primary reason Kale's my best friend is because Kale listens slower than I talk. I kept that sucker in trouble about all his life. And we found some of Kale's grandfather's liquor out in the corn crib. We knew enough about the democratic process that we thought we ought to vote on that, and we did, majority rule, and we drank up grandpa's liquor. And I began to feel that burning sensation as it went down. My knees got a little weak. And all of a sudden, things got funny. And then I was transformed. Now, the first thing I realized is I felt that haircut just straighten up, dead center. And, man, all those parts blended into one. I had 20/20 vision all of a sudden. I was seeing two of everything. I said, man, I don't need these glasses anymore. And man, we just had us a good time. Went down the hill, hid under the plum bushes, and talked about what we'd do to those Brentley girls if they came over the hill. And they didn't come over the hill, and we didn't get to do it. As a matter of fact, I'm glad they didn't come because I didn't know how to do it. But I knew I had to have me some more of that stuff. Now, nobody had told me how to make wine. But we had moved off the farm then, and we were, they had some tree in the yard that had, they said it was black cherries. But I don't know what it was, but I boiled those cherries up there. Gonna make me some wine. Now, I can't make wine today, didn't know it, but I couldn't make wine then either. I can understand, you know, the concept of cyberspace. I understand the ability to get information from nowhere. I've done that all my life, you know. I just know stuff, you know. I don't know. Dennis, how'd you know that? I don't know. Just know. So I boiled that stuff up and poured it in two mason jars. Knew it was supposed to ferment. See, fermentation is when alcohol gets in it, and it won't do it while you're looking. It's got to be dark. So I dug a hole in the backyard, buried that stuff, and went and sat on the back porch for about 5 minutes. Dug that first one up and drank it. Man, I was disappointed. I walked around wondering how the alcohol got in. And it took me about 2 days to complete the process, but I poured some rubbing alcohol in that second one, and that didn't produce a high. It produced the worst case of gas I ever had in my life. You know? But I'm already looking for this feeling again. I entered high school on a college preparatory track, had no idea I could play basketball, had no idea coaches were looking at me. But I drank myself out of that basketball program in 2 years. Drank myself off a school bus route in a year and 19 days. Drank myself from a college preparatory track to a vocational track to a general track, and barely got out of high school drinking wine, shoplifting to local stores, and begging teachers to pass me. Wasted talent. I immediately became a wino. I don't know what looked so attractive to drinking wine. I think Adrian mentioned night train yesterday. And I'll tell you, I had difficulty staying in my seat. I wanted to get up and put my hand over my heart, you know. Like, man, I love a good drunkalogue, you know. That's my kind of stuff. Night train, Thunderbird, you know, Mad Dog, you know. I like that top shelf stuff, you know. My goodness. You got something to get the job done quick, man. Don't be messing around. By the time I got out of high school, it was evident to everybody except me that I was headed for trouble. In the last 2 weeks of high school, I was confronted about my alcoholism four times. The first of those times was with an English teacher. You know, back then, teachers knew your family, your parents, your sisters, everybody. And I walked into class one day. She promptly threw me out, came out behind me and said, "Dennis, I think you have a drinking problem." Well, I did. I was not getting enough. Well, thought maybe she wanted to buy me a couple of fits, you know. And being the smart aleck that I was, you know, I'm thinking, you know, what the teachers know? Plus, she's a preacher's daughter, probably been protected all of her life, you know, and she's an adult. Take two drinks and they think you got a problem. But you know, the next three people said anything about my drinking was 17-year-old classmates just like me. The first of those was another preacher's daughter, Sylvia Spears. She just said, "Dennis, I think you're alcoholic." Now that hurt my feelings, because there's a big difference between being an alcoholic and having a drinking problem. I didn't mind being a drunk or wino or no good, but I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Then there was Linda Lowe. Linda Lowe was so beautiful. I was afraid to get close to her. I thought I might get her dirty or something, you know. And she actually penned in my annual, "Dennis, you're a nice guy. Stay off the booze and everything will be okay." Then there was Janice Morgan. Janice Morgan is so mean and so honest. She's just so forthright that she's still not married today, you know. She tells the truth too much, you know. Janice Morgan actually preened in my annual, "Dennis, someday reality will hit you in the face and you won't know what to do." That's pretty heavy stuff for 17-year-old kids. You know, I drank for 10 more years after that. It's amazing that it took me 10 more years of drinking to see what they saw then. And see, that's why I need a home group. That's why I need a sponsor. That's why I need to be surrounded by people who know me and love me enough to tell me the truth. Because my illness is one that won't allow me to see myself as I really am. And I need people that will tell me the truth when I need to be told. So I joined the Army and started messing up y'all's military service. And Army's a good place to hide out. But before I went, I had to hurt everybody's feelings one more time. They had told me I wouldn't join, I wouldn't be able to get in the Army because my eyes were too bad. I went to see my recruiter, and the recruiter fell in love with my eyes. First thing he saw that he liked about me. But before I went home, hurt my parents' feelings, because they wanted me to do stuff like go to church, come in a reasonable hour, go to technical school. And I went home, Dad sitting on the front porch. The bad guy I didn't need to see. Dad seemed to have a spiritual life comparable to that old-timers have around Alcoholics Anonymous. He just didn't get excited about small stuff. I said, "Dad, I joined the Army." He said, "That's good. You're not doing anything else. Go tell your mama." I mean, you can't even hurt the guy's feelings, you know. And, you know, so I go tell Mom. And Mom started crying and hollering and yelling. And, you know, this is 1971, you know. I said, "Well, I finally got her back, teaching to mess with me." I was down in Fort Jackson about 4 weeks later. I was crying and hollering, rolling all over my bed. I was in bad shape. And did a whole bunch of that. I spent only 6 months in Vietnam. I got back from Vietnam on my 19th birthday. And married my wife 10 days later, August 26th, 1972. And we had had a son while I was in Vietnam, and we went out to Oklahoma and began to do what unknowingly what alcoholic families do: fuss, fight, chase each other for the paycheck. And I'll tell you, that Libra was a natural Al-Anon. She was absolutely accurate with an ashtray at 50 meters or less. Now, I'm telling you, this is not a natural balding pattern, you know. Now, stayed in the Army 8 years. Made a lot, made rank fast. I embarrassed myself out of every assignment the Army gave me. After leaving Vietnam, I was recruited into nuclear weapons, and I was in the nuclear security program. I went back to Germany, and I was on stationed on the Czechoslovakian border there for 40 months. When I got ready to leave, you know, every year I was over there, I had a drinking-related infraction of the law, but I couldn't see that. Because the Army will not let you be in nuclear weapons and have a drinking problem. So they either transferred me, covered it up, fined me. They did something to keep me from being prosecuted. And one of these infractions, I just drove a car right into a lake, you know. And how do you deny that, you know? And I remember that morning, it was cold. I couldn't swim. It's been a while sitting on top of that car, you know. But anyway, I got back from Germany in 1977. We had paid off all of our debts. I had begun to suspect that my drinking was abnormal. Now, I couldn't admit it, but I knew that. And coming back to Germany, we were totally debt-free in June of 1977. But in less than 2 years, I had drank myself into bankruptcy. I had drank myself out of the Army. And my last tour was as a drill sergeant in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I don't think I trained a troop the whole time I was on drill sergeant status. I just think they were scared of me. But then again, that was another one of those positions where nobody messed with me. I was protected. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not see that I had ever had a drinking-related infraction of the law because I had never been convicted. The Army always rescued me. And I'll tell you how terribly low my level of honesty had deteriorated. My thinking was, because I was not convicted, guess what? I didn't do it. And that's just the way I thought. So the Army wanted to get rid of me in 1979, and 79 was a bad year for me. So first of all, my father died. I came home in January of 1979 to bury my father, and he was in a coma for 2 weeks, and I remember my aunt, who was a nurse and a nursing instructor, thought that because I was a drill sergeant, I would be able to handle these things, and she said, "Dennis, you're mother can't accept the fact that your father's going to expire. He's not going to live. And I think you need to go home, get your family, drive back this time, and make arrangements to bury your father." And before I left, she said, "Dennis, you know, we're taught in medical school that there is a point in any illness to which a person can go, that there is no return except by the grace of God. Your father is in that condition." Little did she or I know that I stood before her in that same condition, that there would be no return except by the grace of God. Well, I drank for 2 more years. We moved back to North Carolina, and before moving back, I had 45 more days to do in the Army out there, and went back out for 45 days, and I remember driving back out there thinking, with Libra gone and the kids gone, I can drink wine with authority. Man, that felt good. And I went back out to Oklahoma, and I'll tell you, the utilities started being cut off. I started waking up in places that I had never seen before with people that I didn't know. And I used to say I sold that house, but a kind man kept my house from going into foreclosure. I salvaged $4,400 out of a $21,000 house, sent Libra $1,300, and I woke up out of a blackout in a place called Hobart, Oklahoma, absolutely broke. I don't know what happened to the rest of that money. I didn't understand blackouts back then. So that was the basis for many an argument until Libra and I had made some progress in AA and Al-Anon, respectively. So I came back in North Carolina like a good drunk's supposed to, drinking wine and writing bad checks. And North Carolina seems to frown on that just a little bit. You know, we moved to Greensboro, and Lieber got a job immediately, and I was hired at a local prison unit eventually, and that's when my alcoholism began to blossom. I began to get promoted fast again. I got promoted from first shift to second shift for coming in drunk at 6 o'clock in the morning. Second shift was a little better because, you know, but the problem is I couldn't go home. I mean, what sensible drunk is going to go home at 10 o'clock at night when he's already out of the house? Keep going, man. And then I eventually got on third shift, and that's what I wanted to do. Work all night, drink all day. That way you maximize your waking hours. And I started doing that, and I started seeing little fuzzy things in the dormitory at night, you know, and nobody else seemed to be bothered by them. And I thought I'd get them in the trash can. Sometimes they sneak up on me, you know. Those people inside that prison started writing grievances and signing petitions on me, trying to have me fired for keeping these fuzzballs off of them. I didn't think that had anything to do with my alcoholism, but eventually in 1980, I was invited home for a Thanksgiving dinner. My sisters and my mother had begun to try to find ways to get me in some type of recovery center. They thought that something had happened to me in Vietnam that made me drink like this. And they asked me about going to church. They asked me about spirituality. They talked to me about God. And I'd done the most reasonable thing I knew to do. I just cussed them out. Woke up out of another blackout, headed north on 85, and that night I had that moment of clarity that we hear a lot about in Alcoholics Anonymous. I recall that in 1976, a profound thing had happened at home. My wife's uncle, Dan W., who had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Dan was a town drunk when we were growing up. And he had gotten sober in this strange thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody knew much about it. But they had wrote us to tell us. And my thinking was, when I get back to Greensboro, my wife's going to leave me anyway, so I'll just call Dan and see about this thing called alcoholism. But I got back to Greensboro, and you know what happened. I don't need to call Dan. I can quit on my own. I never had before, but I could then. The first miracle that I can recall happened in my life, Dan called me. Dan was in there. Dan came by. I said, Dan, come on in and make yourself at home. Not knowing that drunks will do that if you tell them that. He took off his shoes and laid down on my sofa and went to sleep. Man, I hated people that could relax like that. So I went out to check my car and checked his car. And in the back of his car, he had an old book. Looked old. You could barely make out Alcoholics Anonymous on it. Had a bunch of pamphlets in the back windshield. And I went around and checked all his door handles. If it had been unlocked, I'd have stole his big book. But I had to go ask him about that big book. I said, Dan, tell me about this thing called alcoholism. And Dan talked for what seemed like 2 hours. Finally, Dan said, well, Dennis, if I dial a number, will you talk? I said, man, if you shut up, I'll talk, you know. And talked to a guy named James, wanted me at his office at 9 o'clock Monday, and I went down there. James was a strange fellow, black guy, clean shaven, had a tie on. His socks and his pants matched. Man, my socks and pants hadn't matched in a long time. Had tan shoes. Gave me a little test. I passed his test. He talked freely about alcoholism. Talked about being locked up, neglecting his family, not paying his bills, being fired, not taking care of himself medically, things of that sort. Man, I didn't talk about myself. I'm a good Southern Baptist. I talk about other people. I don't talk about me, you know. I ain't saying nothing. And didn't. And before, I was uncomfortable in that situation. I wanted out of there. And before I could get out of there, he said, wait a minute. He said, will your wife and kids come into counseling? Well, man, I knew they would. I remember leaving Germany. Lieber and the kids had all kind of friends. Had all kind of farewell parties. Nobody knew me. They always made friends easily. My thinking is, you know, I don't want those kids down here. I think they were like 7 and 5 then or something. And, you know, if you don't, not careful, you know, I know Lieber's going to tell on me. But these kids, You know, you can't let the kids that young in with a counselor. You know, they'll tell the truth on you if you're not careful, you know. And Levy went right into Al-Anon. There were some years before the kids went into Alateen, and things began to change immediately around the house. Levy got right smart mouth, saying stuff like, Dennis, I'm going to the Serenity meeting Monday night. And if you want to go to an AA meeting or anywhere else, you need to make arrangements for the kids. It's about time you do that. You're their father. And she'd just leave. I try to pick an argument. She'd just leave. Just go. Come in sometime later, about 30 days later, she said, Dennis, I want to go to Bonnie Doon. I said, what is Bonnie Doon? She said, well, it's an Al-Anon retreat. I said, well, Libra, how much does that cost? And she'd tell me. I said, Libra, we can't afford that. She said, I can't afford not to. And leave. She'd say, no. Oh, big man, I'm losing ground here, you know. And then the kids just went right into Alateen. Well, I started hanging around these AA meetings. I'd sit near the back, close to the coffee pot. Man, I like your refreshments. You know, we're a little short on groceries at home. And after about 2 weeks, I got to feeling right sorry for you. You guys pile us over alcohol and your life's unmanageable. I said, these guys can't drink liquor. That's what's wrong with them. I'm a young man. I can drink wine. See, my thing, I'm pile us over money, see. My first 21 months sober, my wages were garnished by the United States Bankruptcy Court. So I know it doesn't take money to stay sober. Step two offended me. It implied that I might be insane. Step three had God in it. I thought step four would be a good place to start. I'd heard y'all talking about this novel that you guys were writing on, and didn't seem to be a big deal with me, and by that time they're beginning to bother me about sponsorship. Saying stuff like, boy, have you got a sponsor? And the posse was after me. These old guys. The old fat boys on the back row beginning to close in on me. Came to me one night and said, boy, we've diagnosed your problem. I said, well, you know, I know I'm different. I'm young, gifted, and black. And he said, you seem to be suffering from malnutrition between the ears. I didn't get the taper off of alcohol on those pills and stuff, you know, and it took me a while to figure that out, you know. About 2 weeks later, I show up, and I said, I think AD called me stupid. I said, well, Dennis, it was evident to everybody except me that I was on the merry-go-round of alcoholism. My next drunk was just bound to happen because I wasn't doing anything. Everybody was looking for a sponsor for me, so I figured if they're that concerned about it, I might better start looking myself. So I was having trouble finding sponsorship. Couldn't find anybody black enough. Couldn't find anybody cool enough. Couldn't find a Vietnam veteran. Couldn't find anybody that was married 9 or 10 years. Couldn't find anybody that had kids. There was something wrong with everybody. So I had to do the most logical thing a drunk like me can do. I had to sponsor myself. Okay. Okay, now, if you think you're having a hard time now, sponsor yourself for a while. I'm going to tell you. I sponsored myself for 81 days, counted every one of them. Life is good when you sponsor yourself. Go to meetings when I want to. I never read the big book. Read stuff like GQ, Playboy, you know, stuff like that. Intellectual stuff. You don't need that answering machine when you're sponsoring yourself. Nobody calls when you're sponsoring yourself. And I was sitting in the East Side meeting one night. You know, I reflect sometimes, and I cherish the days when my sponsor and I could sit in the same seat, you know. And the thought occurred to me, you know, Dennis, you know, there might be some other things you can use since you can't drink. But, you know, you just don't go out and start doing stuff like that without talking to your sponsor. And that's what I like about sponsoring yourself. You got direct access. You know. So on the way home, I talked to my sponsor. My sponsor said, yeah, man, there's nothing wrong with that. So me and my sponsor woke up 140 miles from home, drunk and naked, down in Rutherford County. And on February 1st of 1981, I've done the only thing I am positively sure I've done right in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back. Those old guys in the back said, boy, we've been waiting on you. And that night they let me in. That night they had a little meeting after the meeting. And they invited me to the meeting. And that's because I was the subject of the meeting, you know. And when I left that meeting that night, I had the basis for my recovery. I woke up this morning with the same basis for my recovery. And see, those guys didn't have my treatment money, my insurance money, my mom and dad's money. They could talk to me in a language that I understood with no inhibitions. When I left that meeting, I knew that Dennis Nance couldn't keep Dennis Nance sober. I knew that Dennis Nance could not replace his alcohol with any other mood-altering chemical. I knew that Dennis Nance was going to have to effect and maintain a relationship with God as he understood him or he misunderstood him. But that was going to have to happen. I knew that Dennis Nance was going to have to follow instructions from somebody who was successful at staying sober 24 hours at a time, and that's called a sponsor. I went home that night and started praying. I've prayed since. But I'd go in the bathroom and pray. Go in the bathroom, jump on the side of that bathtub. You know, first I'd run some water in the sink, flush the commode, turn on the shower, and say, God, thank you for keeping me sober. While I'm going to bed. About 6 months later, my prayers have changed. I'm praying for the courage to pray in my bedroom. And I've received so many blessings through Al-Anon. Libra comes in one night and she says, Dennis, you know, I've been telling my sponsor I'm going to do something I hadn't been doing. So I followed her back there to see what it was. And she got on the side of that bed before she went to bed. And she prayed. Since that day, we've been able to pray openly in our bedroom. We start and end our days together. Sometimes together, sometimes separately. But it's no big deal. I am so grateful for my kids being in Alateen during their formative years and a wife that's still active in Al-Anon, because I'm convinced that God uses AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And I think God uses Alateen and Al-Anon the same way he uses AA, to rebuild the hearts and minds and lives of family members, the same way the 12 steps do that for us. And I'm grateful to have been a benefactor of that. Life has changed so drastically. The first thing that changed, they issued me a sponsor that night. Just like the Army, they gave me one. They said, Ivy's your sponsor. I said, well, Ivy can't be my sponsor. I said, he's crazy. They said, well, you crazy. That's why you got it. You know? And Ivy worked. Ivy was unemployed, unemployable, living with his mother. Ivy got me started on the steps, got me to step three, and he said, Dennis, you ready for step four? And he sent me to a guy named Lou. Lou worked with drunks all the time, professionally, and he worked me through the steps. He ensured that I took the steps in his apartment at night. And he worked with me initially, steps 4 through 9. And I remember showing up to take my fifth step thinking I'll be out of here in 15 minutes. Some hours later, I left his apartment a free man. I remember the sunset that day. I was driving that old beat-up, raggedy Volkswagen. Boy, I could see the floor. I could see the road as it went along, you know. And I thought that day, you know, I probably don't have to drink anymore if I'll do what these guys tell me. Lou actually had to write out how and what to say when making my amends. And I had worked at that prison then 2 years drunk. And I had done some things in that prison that could have gone to prison myself for. But I had to make those amends and risk going to prison in order to stay sober. And I did that. Life changed tremendously. Libra and I began to leapfrog ourselves through school. And I was promoted 2 times and ended up working for the guy that tried to fire me. The guy that's tried to fire me working for me at that prison. And eventually I left the prison system and went into the mental health field. And you know, it's just gotten better and better and better. Finally, I got my first permanent sponsor, AD. AD does the most loving thing that I think anybody's ever done for me. AD set me down in his apartment on Wednesday nights and taught me what he knew of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember AD telling me many times, "Dennis, if you stay sober, you'll sponsor people. If you sponsor people, if you don't show them how to work, if you don't insist that they work these steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't teach them what you know of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't sponsor them like you were sponsored, you may be cheating them out of the only chance they'll ever have to live sober. So if you can't sponsor them like you were sponsored, you get them to somebody who can." Man, that's a tall order. These guys love me. They insisted that I give something back as soon as I was able to do that. I didn't have any options. They insisted that I mop floors, that I set up chairs, that I make coffee. I smoked for my first 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And even after I quit smoking, they didn't mind if I picked up cigarette butts. I said, "Man, you can do it anyway." I moved to Charlotte, and I immediately began to tell them how we did it in Greensboro. They didn't appreciate that. I was the chief coffee maker. 10 years sober for about 6 months in that group. And they were real nice to you. I was the only black guy in the group. And they'd leave me there washing the coffee pots. And the trash container was sitting out past the cemetery. And man, I'd make sure nobody was looking because I wouldn't think I was cool. And I'd tiptoe around those graves, throw that stuff in the trash can and run back, man, scared to death. Who would have ever thought life would be like it is today? I know people about everywhere I go. It's a blessing. You know, I heard one of the speakers say that she had no regrets. I've received so many blessings in the short time that I've lived. I don't think of any dilemma that I could not handle with you, the God of my understanding, and this program. I'm not here to say everything. My life is without problems. I have marriage problems. I have job problems. I have the same kind of problems everybody else has. This program just gives me a systematic way, a proven way of working through those problems, of addressing those problems. I have a job that's meaningful today. You know, at 13 years sober, I was given an opportunity to go back to school because I felt like I had cheated myself out of my educational goals. And Lieber went back to school and completed her associate's degree, and then our kids were graduating from high school. And it's amazing. Those two little nail-biting discipline problems are productive adults today. And I don't think that's because of good parenting. I think it's the progress they made in reality. And I went back eventually, and I was blessed to complete an undergrad degree and went on to complete a master's. That's just amazing for someone who had no desire to follow instructions. If there's one thing I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the value of following instructions. It is following those instructions that has given me the relationship I have with God as I understand Him today. It's following those instructions that has given me the change of attitude and the life I enjoy today. It's just beautiful. And I think about entering Alcoholics Anonymous at 27 years old, feeling so sorry for myself because I couldn't have fun anymore. I was absolutely sure that I would be the only black guy on the south end of town that could not be cool and dance and party. I'd be relegated to a life in the basement of church for the rest of my life. And I asked myself many times, why have I got to get a sponsor? Why am I an alcoholic? Why have I got to do this? Why have I got to do that? And I think about other people with illnesses, terminal illnesses. They know they're going to die from those illnesses. Cancer, AIDS, brain tumors, kidney disorders. You know, if they had a program like mine and they were asked to do the things that I'm asked to do on a daily basis, if that's all they had to do, you couldn't find a place big enough to get them into. And here I've spent so many hours So many minutes sitting right in the middle of the solution, complaining about the problem. That says a lot about why I need to be here this weekend. Thank you all, and God bless you.